Vocals? You can hear me. Okay. That doesn't work. We'll go this way. How's that? Now? Can you hear me now? Okay. Good. Hi. Welcome to Wednesday. And this is the, excuse me, 6th of September. And if I remember, I will turn off the iPod when we go back to the video, but I wanted to let people know that I was doing that. One announcement. Next Monday is the last day to add or drop courses without your dean's signature. So now's the time to check your schedule online and make sure that you're actually registered for the courses that you think you're registered for, and clean up your schedule if you need to. Most of you won't have to, but there are always those one or two who get an F at the end of the semester because they were registered for a course that they didn't realize they were taking. Everyone, we all have that nightmare, you know. We wake up, when you're 45, you'll still have that nightmare. You'll wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat because you're at an exam, the final exam, for a course that you weren't in. It's a universal dream. So anyway, that'll happen to you. But you can keep it from happening in January by, or the end of December, by dropping those courses you're not in. And if you're not in this one, but you're here, enroll. There's still room. Okay. Any other administrative stuff? Administrivia? Housekeeping? You're easy. Okay, we were in the middle of the video, Life's Greatest Miracle, so this would be the right time to ask if you had observations or questions or comments up to now about what you have seen. And again, a reminder that you can review it, the URL for WGBH Nova is on the syllabus on the schedule at the beginning of the biological unit. And it's worth seeing two or three or four times. Okay, what have we seen so far? A little bit about genetics. Process of creating sperm and ovum. Conception? Yes.
I have a question. When the sperm attaches to the egg, it said it had to fit exactly in that piece. Are all of them possible fits on the egg? They said to fit the right way? Or?
Great question. On the at the point where the sperm actually gets to the ovum, the video described the necessity of having a match of chemical receptors on both. And the video made the point that the ovum is fairly selective. It requires the sperm to actually have the appropriate receptors on its surface. That goes the other way as well. The sperm and ovum have to match. So if the ovum is not a match for the sperm, it just doesn't happen unless there is a match between the receptors on both surfaces. So it's both the ovum being selective and the sperm being selective. It has to be a transaction between the two. They have to fit. The question, which is a very good one, is do all of the sperm have the potential to fit? And are all the sperm ejaculated? I think that's the underlying question. Are all of the sperm ejaculated at one time potential matches, or none of them are? And the sperm vary in different ways, and one of the ways that sperm differ is in the specific receptors that they have on the surface. So the sperm are variable, and a particular person, man, male, may ejaculate sperm, as I understand it, and I'm getting out of, I'm in my speculative mode now. A particular man may ejaculate a certain percentage of sperm, which would be a good fit. And that sperm, that percentage may vary from very low to very high. It's one of the issues in infertility, a mismatch between ovum and sperm. Similarly, ova, as they are elaborated, will also differ in the specific receptors on their surfaces. So a particular woman may not every month ovulate ova that will be a good match for the particular man. It's really a crapshoot in many ways. But one of the variations in ova and in sperm is the specific chemical receptors on the surface.
Yes.
It's a good and logical question. Is it possible that a particular male and a particular female might never have the right match? And my understanding is that that is the case. It's not a high probability event because they're both humans, and humans are pretty pretty adaptable. So we have a wide range. And I don't have any idea, but this is something to pursue in other courses or in your own research. I don't have any idea how many different ways those surface receptors can vary or what they're actually looking for. Peppermint scent or something? I really don't know.
So the term fertile has nothing to do with whether or not those receptors on the sperm, it's more whether or not the sperm ever lives with that particular egg of man and woman.
The second half, it has to do with the specific fit between the sperm and ovum. Infertile might refer to both, to either the male or the female, or both. Okay, but it has to have that match. It's a transactional term. But there are many other ways in which couples can be infertile, and either one might be infertile under any circumstance, receptors or no. But the receptor mismatch is one of the ways in which a couple can together be infertile, even though both of them might be fertile with other people. Yep. Right. Yeah, it's not a theory. I understand that to be the case, that the sperm, some of which have an X and some of which have a Y, which is why the sperm determine whether you're going to have a male or female offspring. The sperm with the Y chromosome swim more quickly, and are actually a little bit lighter. And there is a technique, there are a couple of techniques, but one of the techniques for determining sex for the offspring, if you want to, it's not all that terribly expensive, seems to me like a dumb thing to do, but that's a political comment. You can run your sperm after you ejaculate, if you're careful about where you ejaculate, you can have your sperm sorted. Your sperm can be sorted by a machine which will separate those which have Y chromosomes and those which have X chromosomes, and you can get rid of whichever ones you don't want, and then use the remaining, the selected sperm, either the X or the Y, for insemination in the less fun way of insemination. And then reasonably well guarantee that the conceptus will be either male or female, whichever you have chosen. This is a common practice in some developed countries, such as India, where offspring of one sex are more highly valued than the other, and where couples are trying to determine what sex they have. It's a way of determining in advance rather than waiting until the determination has been made and then selectively aborting the conceptuses that you don't want.
If you can tell that, can they actually look either an egg or a sperm to tell if there's going to be a genetic deformity or a disease? I mean, is it gotten that?
There are some tests that can determine whether the zygote will have particular genetic disorders. So you can screen, and that's done in the expensive cases of artificial insemination, in vitro fertilization. They will screen the ova, the zygotes, before they implant them after conception, and eliminate ones that are suspect. Not for all forms. You need more tissue to do that generally, but you can do some screening. Later screening is easier because after implantation, you can get a sample, a biosample, and actually get the DNA from the conceptus and then run that through genetic testing. That's what the amniocentesis process is primarily for. It's to determine whether or not you're carrying a fetus that has particular genetic disorders. And that's a fairly sophisticated process, and the number of genetic disorders that can be screened for or selected for, determined, is increasing every year. So in addition to figuring out whether it's male or female, you can also figure out whether it has Down syndrome or any other chromosomal defect, and many genetic gene defects. Yeah. So that raises an issue. If you do the screening, then do you then abort the embryo or fetus, or do you just know that you're going to have a child with a genetic defect?
What is the term used to describe the incidence where a woman is born with both chromosomes and has, because I watched the thing about the Virgin Mary, and they were saying how that it's possible that the Virgin Mary was born with, well, or what they consider, you're going technical, that she's born with both chromosomes and that they fertilize inside her or something. Like, there's a very rare occurrence, but I'm just wondering what the term is for that.
The condition would be true hermaphroditism, which is an extremely rare condition. Hermaphrodite has both gonads. What's happened during embryonic development is that things got messed up, and I don't understand the process, but a very, very small number of fetuses develop with one ovary and one testes, one testicle. That's being a true hermaphrodite, is having both gonads. So you're producing sperm and ova. Whether or not they could both elaborate and join in those particular cases is way beyond my biological understanding, so I don't have a clue whether you could do that. No idea. Yeah. Other questions? Okay. If not, I'm going to see if I can get the DVD to work, and we'll go back to it. The review. What? Just checking.
The process is called gastrulation.
Okay. Was it a boy or a girl? How could you tell? And what did they name it? Baby boy. I don't know. Maybe on the website. Observations? Questions? Ready to go out and do that? How long after conception can the mother tell if she's pregnant? First pregnancy, as soon as she gets a test done. So if you do the first alert or whatever it's called, test, about 6 days, 7 days, depends on implantation having happened, because up to that point you don't know. But once implantation happens, the mother's body is responding to the conceptus. And as she starts responding, then the test will pick it up. Without the test, with a first pregnancy, you won't know until things start happening that seem weird and you start guessing that you might be pregnant. Missing the next period, for example, would be a clue. 2 to 3 weeks later. Being able to actually feel the fetus is on the outline that I gave you, somewhere around 5 months or so. So quite some way in. For second pregnancies, many women know very early on because they've experienced the biological changes in their bodies and often recognize them as being the changes of pregnancy, which are pretty much unprecedented. They don't happen unless you're pregnant. My daughter reported that about 10 days in, 14 days in, she was aware that her body was changing in ways that it only changed once before. And that was when she was pregnant. This was her second. And those two, the first two were both girls, and the third one, she began to suspect she was pregnant. Her body was doing different things. And the experience of the biological changes for her was quite different with the third child, and he was a boy. So his embryo, he as an embryo, was doing different things biologically. Fairly early on.
Someone I've
not heard of that. Doesn't mean it doesn't happen. It's just not part of my awareness. The question was, or the observation was, that some women continue to menstruate, but that wouldn't work very well because you'd be shedding the lining in which the conceptus was implanted. And so you might have spotting from the vagina, but once implantation has happened, the lining is going to stay, ideally, unless you're having pregnancy problems, in which case spotting and bleeding can happen at any time, but those would not be a normal pregnancy, as I understand it. Yes? Yeah, either one. In some cultures, it's a normal thing. What? In some subcultures in the United States, all cultures have some recognition of the importance of the placenta. The placenta is an organ. It weighs about a pound, pound and a quarter. If you eat liver, It's somewhat like liver in consistency. It's a bodily organ. It's a very important organ. If you don't have it, you don't develop. And it's delivered usually 15 to 20 minutes, sometimes half an hour, after the fetus. It's often something that new mothers miss because they're focused on the baby. And because the placenta is so much smaller than the fetus, it passes usually fairly easily. But the contractions continue typically until the placenta is ejected. And then it's usually examined to make sure that it was normal. Samples are taken because it's a good source of genetic material. It is part of the fetus. The placenta was created by the conceptus, not by the mother. It's part of the baby, so it's the baby's organ. And in all cultures, you got to do something with it. Some cultures just discard it. Some cultures attribute magical powers to it. In some cultures, the community will eat it, will share it. There are prescribed and ceremonial ways of preparing the placenta to be eaten. It's a way of welcoming the newborn. In some cultures, it's important to dispose of it in a particular way in order to keep evil spirits from getting a hold of it and wreaking havoc on the community or on the newborn. There are many different ways of doing it. My daughter saved her first, froze it, figured at some point she'd find a recipe. I gave her one, but she didn't use it. And then she and her husband moved out of their apartment, but her little brother and his wife moved in to the same apartment. And at some point, my son called and said, "Do you know what this package is in the freezer?" And I said, "Well, I'm not sure, but..." And so he called his sister, and she said, "Oh, yeah. Fix it if you want." It's an important source of protein, and so in some culture, in many other species, the mother eats the placenta. It's a rich source of nutrients, and that's the way to dispose of it. It's a high protein dish, and human beings have probably done that for as long as you want. Yes. Yes, cord blood, the blood that is taken from... Do you have an answer?
Oh, no.
Okay. The fetus's blood that remains in the cord, which is after birth, essentially none, but before birth, cord blood is often drawn because it's easy to get to, or placental blood, but... cord blood can be used to assay the contents of the fetus's blood. And right now, one of the things that has been done is to use it to look for chemical precursors of disorders. There is a study in England that I'm following in Great Britain where they've taken cord blood during amniocentesis for the last 20-some years, and they are following the children, and it's a major study of the development of autism and several other disorders. So they're going back and looking at differences in the cord blood of people who develop particular disorders. It's also the major source of measures of prenatal androgens. When people are looking for sex differences, cord blood is one of the important sources of that. It's also, if you collect it in certain ways, it's a source of stem cells for stem cell research. Well, if you have your tubes tied, it's very difficult to conceive because the sperm can't get to the ovum. There have been cases where the sutures aren't complete, where the tube continues to, one of the tubes continues to function to some extent. And those are typically older techniques. The same is true for vasectomies. Older techniques, literally, they tied the tubes with sutures. But now, with vasectomies at least, they cut them, turn them back, tie them, cauterize them, so they're not going to work and you're not going to be able to reverse that. I'm not sure what the technique is for tying tubes now, but if it has, in order to survive, the conceptus has to somehow get into the uterus. So the only way you could do that would be with your tubes tied, would be to extract ova directly from the ovaries, remove them from the body, fertilize them outside, and then implant them in the uterus. In other words, bypassing the fallopian tubes to do that. To make that happen without surgical intervention kind of boggles my mind. The question is, would eating the placenta be considered cannibalism? I believe, this is debatable, I believe that the definition of cannibalism includes killing the meal. I believe that's part of the process of cannibalism. I do not believe, and this would be the test, I do not believe eating the organs of the dead is considered cannibalism. I think that's a different term, and I don't know what it is. And I somehow can't imagine that we would consider it cannibalism, but it's an interesting point. Yeah. And probably in some societies they do, and therefore it would be taboo to eat the placenta. And aren't cultures, the cultural variations around the world are just absolutely fabulous. You had your hand up a long time ago. Way up. No. And we'll talk about that when we look at adaptations after birth. Jaundice refers to the deposition of metabolic byproducts, specifically bilirubin, which is one of the things that builds up in your body as you metabolize protein. And the liver removes bilirubin, it breaks it down, so that it's harmless. Bilirubin itself is quite toxic in large quantities. And what the body does with bilirubin, if you get hepatitis, if you get jaundice, some of you have had that happen, if you've had liver damage, if you have hepatitis, which means your liver is inflamed, some people have that happen as a consequence of mononucleosis. If the liver is not functioning, then the bilirubin is not broken down. It's broken down by enzymes that are secreted by the liver. And if it builds up in the body needs to do something with it. And the body stores the excess bilirubin under the skin. And so you first see the bilirubin in the whites of the eyes. Bilirubin is a yellow pigment. It's a fatty stuff. And it's a pigment, and so it builds up in the skin, and as it builds up, the body puts it there because it's, well, for two reasons. One is that that's less damaging. If you let it build up in the brain, which is where it wants to be, it will cause brain damage and death. But the body, in its wisdom, puts bilirubin under the skin because if you expose the skin to light, the bilirubin breaks down. The bilirubin is photoresponsive and it breaks down into its components when you expose it to sunlight. So the reason that some newborns are jaundiced is that they're beginning to metabolize protein as they start to nurse. Mother's body is not taking care of the bilirubin for them. So it's building up, building up in their blood. And their livers aren't functioning well enough to take care of it. And it's usually just a matter of a day or two or three. But if it goes on for very long, then you need to treat that. And the way you treat it is to put the baby under grow lights or in the sun. So you see in the nursery, in the hospital, the jaundiced babies have their eyes bandaged, blindfolds on, and they're under grow lights, which was a technique developed here at the UVM by Dr. Lucy, who was in Europe. He is one of the world's experts on taking care of newborn and particularly premature babies. And he talked to nurses in France and in England about how they took care of their sick babies, and he was rather startled that the old wives' tales were still alive and well in Europe, because the head nurses would say, well, we put our sick babies by the window and they seem to do better there. And he thought that was, dumb. Until he checked with a friend of his who was a chemist who said, yeah, that makes sense because bilirubin is a yellow pigment and it breaks down under sunlight. And that would happen through the skin. So Jerry Lucy brought that technique back to Vermont, but there's a problem in American hospitals. Our nurseries tend to be in the middle of the building without windows. So he put them under grow lights instead. And it works. Sunlight works as well, but the dosage is a little, we're in Vermont, right? Does the sun shine when you need it? No, of course not. So he invented phototherapy for jaundiced babies. I had occasion to use that knowledge recently. My mother-in-law suffered some liver damage because of medication she was taking and became incredibly jaundiced. Boy, was she sick. She was really sick. She said she'd never been that sick in her life. I told her to, she was being treated for it, but I said, if you want to speed up the process, go sit in the sun. She did. She's recovered. Not because I told her, but because they gave her powerful medications and her liver is... liver is one of the nice organs because it regenerates up to a point. Other questions? Yes. I'm sorry. Cravings for certain foods. Beats me. But one of the functions of the human body is to find food for you and to figure out what is edible and what is useful. And it does that by matching in very strange ways that I don't understand at all, but when you need particular kinds of food, the taste buds that are and smell, the odor detectors, those cells in your nose are more responsive apparently to the kinds of nutrients that you need. And that's, if you want to understand how that system works and spend the next 30 years studying it, you get a Nobel Prize for understanding that process. But for many women, for many people, the selective preferences for smells is guided by what your body needs, and we really don't understand much of that process at this point. During pregnancy, responsiveness to taste and smells often is very greatly accentuated. And whether that's part of the evolutionary process of making sure we eat the right things when we're pregnant, or whether it's just a byproduct of all the other changes going on in the body, I have no idea. Both of those are possible as far as I can tell. But many women find that certain foods that they have loved all their lives are suddenly, don't bring that in the house, you know, and if you cook it, I'm going to vomit. They're just, you know, terrible changes in taste, most of which disappear, but some of which don't. Some people, because of bad experiences during pregnancy, have a low tolerance for the odor or the taste of particular foods, and they retain that for a long time. Other people discover that they absolutely love some food that they couldn't stand before. And the pickles and strawberry ice cream thing is real. I don't know why. I don't know. But you know, you check with your own mothers if you can. Ask them, you know, how their food preferences change. We've got about 5 more minutes, so a couple more questions.
If it takes such perfect circumstances to get pregnant, why do we go through all the motions of severe birth control methods?
If it takes such perfect conditions to get pregnant...
Yeah, like, why couldn't you just not have sex when you're ovulating?
That system works. Not having sex, not having intercourse is a very fine way to keep from getting pregnant. And in many cultures, that's the way. And the problem, and Lithgow commented on it, and I'll elaborate on it, is that ovulation is not predictable. And the notion that many people have, and you probably read it in your biology text in high school, if you got to that point, most of us didn't get, you know, we got up through frogs and then there was never time for the 3 chapters on human beings, so we didn't learn about that. But the reality is that ovulation is a highly variable process, and for some women it's extremely variable. The notion that you ovulate on the whatever it is day after you've menstruated fits a very small minority of women. And many women ovulate twice, or the 2 ovaries ovulate at different times. So you may be fertile through a fairly long period of time because you're fertile from the time the ovum gets into the fallopian tube until it gets out of the uterus actually, until it breaks down. And if you've ovulated 2 or 3 ova and perhaps at different times from the 2 ovaries, you could be fertile. You could be ready to conceive over the course of 2 or 3 weeks between periods. And so it's not as regular as menses is. Many of you are on very specific and very regular schedules. You know exactly when you're going to menstruate. But ovulation is highly variable within that period and between those periods. Within that period of time. I can't get there without going through the period. And ovulation is highly variable. There was a Canadian study about 4 years ago that was published that looked at the actual ovulation of a fairly sizable group of women and was very startled. That, you know, just blew everything that's in your textbooks about what day of the cycle you ovulate, just blew it out of the water. That's just mythology, because most of the women in the study did not ovulate regularly. And they often ovulated twice or 3 times during that month. And so the rhythm technique, if you practice it, really doesn't work. Rhythm technique depends on being able to know when you ovulate. And you can track your temperature, you can track your hormones if you want, and you can do that. But to effectively work, essentially you have to reserve intercourse for during your menstrual period to be really safe. And most couples, I don't know why, people seem to, they get together, they get mated, they start having a sexual relationship, and it's very difficult for them to wait to have intercourse for those times that are safest. And it's just one of those things. Because, as Lithgow said at the beginning of the video, all those people out there are trying to reproduce. And that's what DNA is for, and that's what the reproductive system is for. It's to reproduce. So we have actually a fairly high probability of reproducing if we're sexually active. And we seem to have a hard time not being sexually active. I don't understand it, but it's there. So it's difficult. Okay, bring your handout on prenatal development on Monday, and we'll go through that quickly.